whatever weighs.
I'd like to discuss the issue that I'm sure that's been nagging at you people for some time now, the issue of a mitochondrial DNA replacement. I know many people have lost a lot of sleep over this. Worry no more. Let me give you a little bit of a background to what in the world we're talking about. So without getting too involved in the basics of human reproduction, it involves a sperm and an egg. We are focusing today on the egg. And the egg, again, I'm not a doctor, so this is going to be somewhat of a basic explanation. Like all good eggs, there's a shell and there's the stuff inside. What's inside the nuclear DNA is the DNA that we talk about that makes you who you are. The outside is also made of DNA, but that's called mitochondrial DNA. That's a very small amount of the DNA compared to the big picture. The mitochondrial DNA is passed down from mother to child. The sperm does not mix with it. It does not get involved in it. There are diseases that are related to the mitochondrial DNA. And if a mother has mitochondrial DNA disease, there is a very good chance that it will get passed to the child. Around, 10, 15 years ago, an idea was hatched which came up with the following idea. Now, this was unrelated to what we're talking about now, not totally unrelated. But as a woman gets older, the quality of her eggs go down. And the question is, and therefore because of that, if a woman is already in her low to mid-40s, the chances of success through natural means or through IVF go down significantly year after year. The question is, would it be possible to take an older, as far as we're concerned, woman's egg, suck out the DNA, that which makes it her, and then take a younger woman's egg, suck out that DNA, get rid of the younger woman's DNA, put the older woman's DNA into the younger woman's egg, and then fertilize that. And that would give the older woman, and then once it's fertilized, you could take the embryo and implant it in the, what we will call, older woman. All of this does, but they did it maybe 30, 50 times successfully.
Out of how many
trials? I don't know how. It seems they were successful maybe 1 out of 4 times. It's hard to say.
That's pretty good. That was
pretty excellent, in fact. And they had, in fact, made several children that way. And what happened, however, was there was not a crazy high, but a higher incidence of birth defects that came out of these children. Namely, of these 30 to 50 children that were born, at least 2 of them had what's called Turner syndrome, and 1 of them had a form of autism.
What's Turner?
Turner syndrome is a chromosomal abnormality.
Yes.
What?
Two X's.
No,
X's.
It's
in the girl.
Uh-huh. An extra X.
XXY.
XY. It's not triple X. It's XXY.
So what happens with this child?
New York's chromosomes are different.
Right.
It's not really big enough sample size.
So this was enough to make them nervous about it, right? So Turner's, again, for example, a young lady that's born with Turner syndrome has no eggs. She'll never be able to have children, for example. No, it's a chromosomal problem that shows itself in that way among others. So because of that, the FDA stopped it. And they said none of this procedure anymore until it can be studied. And in fact, this procedure is illegal in most of the world. It is legal, however, in England. that was a pretty good guess. Illegal in the United States, but legal in Vegas. That was a pretty good guess. But you know, But in this case, no, it happens to be England. Now, the focus at this point, a few years later, as they work on this and they try to bring it back, is for a really different reason. The focus is less on infertility now, and more it is for taking care of mitochondrial diseases. There are certain diseases which are passed down via the mitochondrial DNA, and the idea is if I could take this woman's nuclear DNA and put it into another woman's mitochondrial DNA, she'll have children that are biologically, for all intents and purposes, her child. We're going to use the important parts of her egg. She's going to carry the child to gestation. And it will know, and with that, we'll be able to rid the child of potentially having the disease.
In a healthy situation, what does the mitochondrial DNA give the child?
What the mitochondrial DNA, again, there are people here who know more than me, but my understanding is mitochondrial DNA are basically the batteries that run the DNA. It gives the energy, etc. Again, it doesn't really express itself in brown eyes versus blue eyes, but without it, the whole thing wouldn't work. Feel free to correct me whenever. Right. So that battery thing wasn't way off.
It's within the cell.
Right.
I didn't hear you say it again.
It has to do with all the functions within the cell.
So it makes those
things happen. It makes RNA, it makes a bunch of other things.
Mm-hmm. So his analogy is good or not good?
Yeah, mm-hmm. The motor.
Right. The motor, the battery, whatever it is. So that is the idea of mitochondrial DNA replacement. The idea is either for fertility purposes, for an older woman who has an egg quality issue, or for a woman who has a mitochondrial DNA disease, right? The idea would be to use this mitochondrial, it's strange to call it mitochondrial replacement. It's really the mitochondria stays. It's you're replacing the insides, the nuclear DNA. But the question is that something that's ethically okay? And if so, there are definitely a fair amount of halachic issues that come with it. We start with an article from the New York Times less than 2 years ago. It tells a story that happens in a Mexican clinic. A healthy baby boy is born in New York to a couple from Jordan. It was the first live birth of a child who has been called, to the dismay of scientists who have say the term is grossly misleading, a three-parent baby. Why is it a three-parent baby? Right, because you have the father and two mothers. The method used to help us cause one of reproductive scientists have been itching to try, but it is enormously controversial because it uses genetic material from a donor in addition to that of the couple trying to conceive. The purpose is to overcome flaws in a parent's mitochondria that can cause grave illness in babies. Mitochondria cells' energy factories are separate from the DNA that determines the child's inherited traits. But mutations in these little organelles can be devastating, resulting in fatal diseases involving nerves, muscles, brain, heart, liver, skeletal muscles, kidney, and the endocrine and respiratory systems that often kill babies in the first few years of life.
Rabbi, is there a way then, for Tay Sachs, they can draw blood and test it and see?
So again,
for this kind of a problem, is there a test so that they...
Well, if you have a first child that has that has the disease, you know it's a problem. If you give birth to a child that has a mitochondrial defect, you'll know that there's a problem with the mother, and there's potential that the next child will have the problem as well.
To do for the first child.
So again, it's...
So there's no blood work.
It's kind of off topic here, so we're going
to
hold off on that.
Needs
right. So basically, the story here was there's a doctor from New York. He's done research in the area, but he can't do the procedure because it's illegal. Therefore, he goes down to Mexico. He does it there, right? Then the child, it happens to be a Jordanian couple in this case, right? The mother had a mitochondrial disease, and this was able to overcome it. So this is what's going on. This is a very important topic. Right now there is, as far as I know, one doctor's office, one clinic that will do this for you regularly. and it's located in the Ukraine. And they have lists of patients who fly out to use them. Among them, Israeli patients have gone out there.
They all do it in Israel, I'm surprised.
Right. There is an article written in 2015 by Rabbi Tendler and Dr. John Loike, which is wholly unsatisfying. There are, of course, halacha considerations concerning the newborn that emerge from such a mitochondrial replacement therapies. First, how does halacha view the fact that the child is created using three genetic donors? The issue has been discussed in a previous publication regarding human cloning, claiming that all three genetic cells may have halachic status. One might, however, argue that MRT, mitochondrial replacement therapy, differs from traditional cloning of mitochondrial donors only supplying an extremely small amount of DNA, 37 genes out of over 20,000 genes in the human genome, to the embryo. The response to this argument might hinge on the fact that mitochondria is critical to life. An embryo cannot develop into a child without mitochondrial DNA. This simply cannot be ignored, despite the fact that mitochondrial DNA only contributes a fraction of the genetic information. There are other complex issues related to MRT that must be evaluated in the future. What is the religious status of the child, for example, when one of the female donors is not Jewish? In halacha, religion is maternally transmitted. If an embryo is conceived using DNA from two women, do they both have to be the Jewish for the child to be considered Jewish? Another example is related to pinyon aveim. Normally, the first male child born from a mother who is a bat levi or bat kohen does not require a pinyon aveim. What about a child born from a mother who is a bat kohen or bat levi but received its mitochondrial DNA from a donor who is a bat Yisrael? Similarly, would a child born from a bat Yisrael require a pinyon aveim when the mitochondrial donor was a bat levi or bat kohen? A third halacha is whether MRT-generated child can marry a direct relative of the mitochondrial donor. These are all really good questions.
Yeah, they are.
We don't know.
What about Avelis?
Right? Another good one. This is what...
Which
mother do you think Shiva? I hear you. Right? Halacha specifically permitting or prohibiting marriage to a relative. All these halachas are quite complex and require halacha analysis beyond the scope of this article. We hope to address them in future articles. Well, that's a pretty big letdown.
What's YYH?
I assume it's supposed to be IYH. I assume that's supposed to be. I copied it as it was written, but I assume it's supposed to be Im Yirtzah Hashem.
Oh, okay.
That's what I think he probably meant to write there. So we've got a problem here, and the problem is when you are dealing with two, at least, mothers. Now, let's be honest. You could use more than that. I could take the mitochondria from one mother and then mix nuclear DNA from two mothers. I make an egg out of that.
Why would you be doing that?
Because I'm a glutton for punishment.
No, no.
I mean, that again, why would I do it?
Well, I'm saying, if the issue is we're just speaking about disease, why would your suggestion even come up?
Because two lesbians want to have a child together.
Okay. I get it.
So the bottom line here is the question of maternity is very serious. And this is not theoretical. This is something that has happened. There were a series of cases. And this is something which we can look forward to happening more and more. Right now, the hold that's being put on right now is a temporary hold in all likelihood. At some point, they will do research and they will find out that this is dangerous, this is not dangerous. There'll be a decision that if you do it this way, it can happen. Yes?
It just occurred to me, I don't know if you discussed it before, what would happen if one of these mothers would be non-Jewish and the parents are Jewish? Would the baby be a goy?
So that's the fact, that was one of the questions, right? Yeah. Meaning that if I take the Jewish...
Well, the non-Jewish mother normally, you know,
right, so again, you're going to have to make a decision here of...
Who is the mother?
Who is the mother?
I mean, this is very complicated.
We had this with Mari Pesach.
They had this with surrogate mothers.
What?
When they were taken...
Surrogate mothers is also an issue. Maybe.
Correct.
We have talked about
surrogate mothers, and that's exactly where we're heading right now. Because let's be honest, there's definitely a strong possibility of three mothers... If I have mitochondrial DNA together with nuclear DNA to make my egg, which I fertilize, and then I put it into a surrogate mother. Right?
Yes, you could do that.
Right? And that would be, I mean, not that I could do that, and that I could see that happening. Again, if I'm doing this in particular for the sake of a older woman, meaning a woman mid-40s or so, right? And that's the reason I'm going to go for a new mitochondrial DNA, I might also in that case be wanting to go for a surrogate, right? Depending on the status of the uterus. So again, it's not beyond reasonable to be dealing here with three different mothers here. So the question that obviously we'd like to focus on here is, who is the mother, right? Yossi's question about is the kid Jewish or not, right? All the other questions that we have here come down to what determines the mother. In the case of the egg, is it the kishkis, the actual genetic material that's going to make you tall or short and give you blonde hair or brown hair, as you know, etc., etc.? Or is it the egg overall? The mitochondrial DNA is the we'll call it the shell because that's where it is. Is that what does it? Now, of course, we have to understand there's a very easy way of getting out of this question. If I were to determine that in the case of the surrogate mother, or in the case of the egg donor, the birth mother is the mother, then I got no problems.
Yeah, but didn't we determine
the other way? I didn't determine anyway. Right? 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 Let's think about it that way.
Okay.
Basically, when it comes, men don't do a lot in this whole making children business, right?
No, you don't.
Right? Women, on the other hand, besides providing the biological material, much like men do, then there's a whole another 9 months, and then this thing called labor at the end, they understand, right? So therefore, the question is, well, what makes the mother the mother? Is it the fact that the child is genetically similar, right? That the mother provided the egg that makes him? Or is it the act of delivery, right? Is it that I gave birth to this is my child? That's the question, right? Now, the question that we are dealing with right now of, is it the mitochondrial DNA or the nuclear DNA, that is an entire discussion entirely within the discussion, assuming that it is the biological mother that is the mother. Because if it was the birth mother, so I don't care, you can give whatever you want, but whoever it pops out of, that's the mother. That's that. So let's go back to that question.
Excuse me.
Yes.
You alluded to it earlier. It seems to me that the DNA, the biological part, is number one, the biggest part of this egg, that the mitochondrial is smaller part and the lesser number of...
It definitely has the lesser number of genes.
Genes. So, and that's the part that determines the characteristics of the child, that the mitochondrial is just the, if you will, the battery.
Mm-hmm.
It would seem to me that there's more weight to be had on the DNA piece, on the biological.
So again, you're saying let's follow majority. If basically this has 20,000 and this has 37,
right?
That's an easy one.
Yeah.
The question is, yeah, we'll discuss that possibility, but when you can't get by without the 37. You can't just ignore it.
No, I'm not ignoring it, but I like the analogy of the energy or the battery.
Mm-hmm.
But the battery is, I mean, it doesn't determine, as you said, blue eyes or green eyes. Or I mean, it doesn't disturb.
It does. It does. A little bit it does.
I thought it did not.
I think a little bit it does, yes. I don't know if we could point our fingers at what it is. Again, if it didn't, there wouldn't be diseases going down with it.
I'm understanding it to be the energy that
you... Again, in terms of who you are genetically, the nuclear DNA is far more important.
Right. But it's important to know that if you don't have a healthy mitochondria,
right.
I get that.
Mm-hmm.
So
you can't ignore it.
But I'm saying it's very...
Thank you, Dr. Marsha.
My point is, if we
assume that the father is the donor of the egg.
What? Okay. I don't know if he's the donor. I mean, what? The father is the provider of the sperm.
Right, that's what he did. Yeah. So, therefore, he's the father irrespective of who carries the end result. But the question also arises, and we've discussed it before, is if it's a donor sperm, who's the father then?
Right. It's hard to say anyone but the donor. Like, who else is in the running? Well, again, the difference is his father, his follows. When it comes to the father, there is no either or, as opposed to the mother. Again, logically, you know, it's there is, it is a little difficult to accept that a Jewish woman gives birth to a child, and we announce that the child's not Jewish because it's someone else's. I'm not saying it's impossible. But at first blush, that would seem to be odd. And if you tell me that, yeah, the mother is the same as the father, that's what it means in our case. So the first question is whether we get to this question. Meaning that if we can determine that it is the birth mother and not the biological mother, then this question becomes moot. So we've looked at this correct years ago, but we'll revisit it again. A few cases in the Gemara. Obviously, there is no case in the Gemara that talks directly on point, but we do have certain cases which might be helpful. For example, we have the Mishnah in Yevamos. So Hagiyarishin is Garu Baneo Ima. If a woman who's pregnant with twins decides to convert. So, the question is, are the brothers related to one another?
The twin brothers?
The twin brothers.
Of course, they're twins.
Well, if twin non-Jews decide to convert, would they be related to each other halachically?
You mean adult people? Adult twins?
Yeah.
Well, they're related, but They're not both Jews. Only one is a Jew.
No, let's say they both converted.
Of course they're related.
No, nope.
They're not related?
They're not related. When a person converts, they're related to nobody.
But what about a baby? When a mother who's pregnant converts,
before the
small baby,
born,
isn't he considered Jewish?
Well, can babies
before
marry
the baby's born.
If the babies were girls, could they marry Kohanim?
What?
If the babies were girls.
So that's the question.
Well, let's go back to the original question before we get there.
So the story is as follows. In the case of a pregnant woman who converts, according to many opinions, is the closest thing that we have to being conceived in one woman and born in another. Because the pregnant woman who converts, a non-Jewish woman conceived these children, and a Jewish woman gave birth to the children.
Okay.
So is this child Jewish or not?
I thought if she converted before giving birth, those children are Jews.
So we definitely say they're Jews, but we're not sure why. Is it because when the mother converts, they convert with her?
That was my understanding.
Or no, if the child is born of a Jewish mother, the child is Jewish.
I thought it was the first. Because they're like part of her.
So again, there are two opinions. Again, if they were part of her, then they would be born Jewish.
Right.
Right? However, if they were separate from her, then they would have converted in utero.
Okay.
So that there are those who will point to it and say, aha, that is the question we're dealing with here. Okay. Right? Because again, even though it is, yes, it's the same woman, still, originally, these children were conceived in a non-Jewish woman, and then the Jewish woman gave birth to them. If you tell me that they are converts, and hence not related to one another, then I am saying that what matters is the biological mother. Conception is what matters.
We've just been spending all these weeks on abortion and, you know, when is a baby a baby? When is it a human being? if it's in utero...
And what did we say?
Well, there were different things at different points.
Mm-hmm. Right, right, so that doesn't help us so much now, does it?
Well, again, these are just embryos at this point. They're not human beings. They've not been born. Their heads are not out. So I would think...
And according to Moshe, if I seek to kill them, would be murder.
Exactly, but we don't go always by what he said.
Not always.
Your position. Mm-hmm. My point is that we don't say that that's a baby until it's born.
No. We said that that's a matter of dispute.
Because for the first 40 days or 45, it's not a human. Why does it matter if it's human?
According to some opinion.
It's a Jewish embryo. It's a Jewish embryo.
Right, right.
If it's a boy and a girl, can they get married?
So.
That's right. They're not related yet.
So the Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us that if a brother, forget it, that's not the escape, a brother and sister decide to convert. So technically they should be allowed to get married. However, we do not allow it because being Jewish can never be easier than being not Jewish. Since they couldn't get married beforehand, the basic halacha shver is on the yid, and we have to keep it that way. So again,
what I read is that one was conceived when she was not Jewish and was born when she was Jewish.
Correct. Right. So Giyosh is going to Baneha Ima. Right? Lo Choltim Velo Meyabdim. So this case is talking about if they just go and they convert when she does. But the Gemara goes on to talk about the other cases. So again, obviously, the Mishnah is saying, obviously, if they convert on their own. Right, so again, this case is talking about, for example, two brothers convert, and then one of them dies childless. Does the other one have to do chalitza or yibum to the sister? The answer is no, because they're not related halachically. However, if we're talking about when it was in utero, that becomes questionable. So this is one area where you can perhaps draw a parallel to our case. Another case which they point, which is an interesting one.
Wait, are they Jewish or are they not Jewish? I mean, they are Jewish, but are they twins or are they not Jewish?
So again, that is a matter of dispute. In that case, happens to be even further confusing for a different reason, but we're going to try to stick on. This topic is confusing enough, so we're going to stay with this confusing topic for now. In the case of Esther, it says, Ki ein lo av va'em. It says that Esther did not have a father or a mother. Ubimos avia v'ima. She said she did not have a father and mother when her father and mother died. So what do you need to say both of them? Obviously, she doesn't have them because they died. Amarav acha ivrasa meis aviha yeldasa meisa ima. Her father died while her mother was pregnant. Her mother died in childbirth. So therefore, she never had parents. So wait a second.
They would never go after her. They would go after her father. And even if it's the point of mentioning her father, it says we go after her mother.
Again, it says that, therefore, she lived with Mordechai. I don't want to ruin the Megillah for you. But, you know, this has nothing to do with status. This is the story. See, so then she would know Mordechai, and then, you know, then Achashverosh, you know. Right, you know? Then we got drunk. Right? So, the idea is that even though it seems that the mother died prior to the actual birth, she died in childbirth, still she's considered the mother.
And the father seems to still be considered the father.
What? Right, the father, we said, for sure.
Right.
The father's the easy one. Again,
Okay.
Right, if you remember, we discussed this, I think, last year, maybe the year before, about in the case of IVF, maybe the person who provides the sperm is the father, maybe nobody's the father. Right? But there's no one else who's really in the running here.
What do you mean nobody is the father? The person who's the donor? It could be the real...
There is a halachic possibility that someone doesn't have a father. Right? For example, if a Jewish woman marries a non-Jewish man and they have a child, mm-hmm. That child is considered fatherless. Okay. As far far as we're concerned. The Mishnah Halachos in number 5, these are all things that we've seen before, gives a very interesting case where he talks about what happened with Dina. There's a famous Rashi which says that after Leah had 6 sons, and then Bilhah and Zilpah each had 2 sons, so everyone knew there were only going to be 12 sons. So how many were still in the running? There's only 2 to go. And with that, Leah became pregnant again, and she realized if she had another child, another son, then the most sons Rachel could have would be 1. And that would be less than Bilhah and Zilpah. She'd have even less than the maidservants. So because of that, she prayed, and according to our version of things, what it sounds like is she prayed, and the child she was going to have became a girl. So, according to that, and it's interesting, people talk about that. What do we know about Dina's personality? She was a little bit of a tomboy. She was a Yatsanis. What?
That's what Rashi says, Yatsanis.
Right, Yatsan, correct, absolutely. And who was supposed to be, the child that she kind of switched with was Yosef. And what do we know about Yosef? Salsa Basara. He used to play with his hair. Right, so.
The playboy.
Right, so that's. So I wouldn't say that necessarily, but so that is our version of things. There's a Medrash, however, which says not that way. The Medrash says that the child that was in Leah's womb and the child that was in Rachel's womb swapped. I mean, Yosef started off in Leah, and Dina started off in Rachel, and they swapped. They were pregnant at the same time, right? That's not so hard to accept. So that may be relevant as well, because each one was conceived by another mother, right? So let's say Yosef was conceived by Leah, but she's given birth by Rachel, and Yosef is clearly considered the son of Rachel. So that would point to birth mother. So this is a matter of great discussion. The last source that people point to is Rabbi Kiva Eger. Yes?
Just back up a little bit to the Esther story.
Yes.
What did that add to the discussion?
They add to the discussion that a mother is considered a mother even if she's dead before the time of birth. So these are all potential sources. Rabbi Kiva Eger's source number 6 is a little bit more difficult to understand. It's when it comes to Basar B'Chalav. So there's a halacha many people are familiar with, that if an animal dies and then there's still milk in the other, that milk is parv. Why? Mm-hmm. It has to be royrios aim. It has to be able to be a mother of the animal, and therefore the milk is coming from an animal that can't be a mother anymore. What if the animal is a trefa? So that's a discussion as well. And in the discussion, Rabbi Kiva Eger points to the fact that the definition of being an aim is just becoming pregnant, not delivering.
Does trefa affect its ability to conceive?
Right, trefa, the assumption is the trefa will be able to get pregnant, but will not be around long enough to give birth, and still that's considered. So we have your sources going both ways. What? Yotzim and Aser, it's a different reason.
Well, that's the whole
right. Also, yeah. Right. So, the bottom line is there are sources that point both ways. Nowadays, if I had to point to a majority opinion of who is considered the mother, it's likely the birth mother. Again, there's not 100% agreement on that at all, but it's likely the birth mother. Being that it's likely the birth mother, right, then we don't have this problem necessarily. right? In terms of, if I tell me to tell you the birth mother is what counts, the problem is no one's convinced of that, though. And therefore, yes. So right now, it is not possible for the birth mother to be the cow.
If it was,
you'd be fleshic.
Mm-hmm. It's like Dr. Seuss book, are you?
Well, right, correct.
This is like when they first started with the IVF stuff, and they were taking women off the street practically, either fertilizing them or the father of the husband was having sex with them to get them pregnant so that at least one half would have a baby. All kinds of crazy things, and then they were saying who was the mother, because the surrogate mother wanted the baby, and they had paid her a certain amount of money to do this.
Baby M.
The baby. Well, there were a lot of them. So this is kind of getting into the same issue. I don't know if they're still have. Then these donors, the male sperm donors, or creeps, a lot of them, and they donated.
Marsha, I think we might be off topic here.
Well, it all creates a big problem.
It's true. We should try to avoid creeps. I'll agree with that. But I think we might be off topic at this point. Yeah, he was really creepy. Anyhow, okay. Now, the question here is, though, which is an important question, Is there any rule that you can only have one mother?
There's no rule except that we make all kinds of decisions about a child based on who the mother is.
Right, but why can't you have multiple mothers? Okay, that should, because that I would admit that the overwhelming majority of people have one mother.
Correct.
Right, and that's more than enough for most of them. Right.
Reference is the single mother.
Of course.
Right, but I don't know if we can make a whole drush out of that.
No rule on it.
So, some people point to the fact that there does seem possibilities to have multiple fathers. For example, there's a Rashi. I never saw anyone else quote this, by the way. It's interesting. I don't know why. It says, "Ves pasrusim ves kasluchim asher yotzvim plishtim." So going through the, this is in the end of Parshas Noach, going through the list of people. So he said, and Pasrusim, that's one name, and Kasluchim, between the two of them, they had Plishtim. So Rashi's Mishneim Yatsu, Shev Pasrusim, Kasluchim, Machalfim, Mishka, Mishoseim. The both of them slept with the same woman, and between the two of them, they had Plishtim. What? So that's not so agreed upon, right? Vaharaya, look at the next source. In Sota, it talks about Goliath. And it says at the end, Rav Yochanan Omer bar meya papi, v'chada na'ani. So what does that mean? So Rashi says, ben tarovish bar harbe enoshin alimo, many men slept with this guy's wife, b'layla achas, so one night, v'nis'abra min ha'echad. But only one of them made her pregnant. Right? Now it's Aviv, Akulam, and Afim, and all the rest were just over on Niyuf, on adultery. Tosfos disagrees. Tosfos says, no, that's actually not what it means. It's not that she had one father. She had 100 fathers, because it is possible if multiple men sleep with a woman in succession, it's possible that multiple sperm enter the egg, and therefore you could have multiple fathers. That is the opinion of Tosfos. What? 100 seems to be a lot. That is true, but that's what the Gemara says.
Well, but we've seen this in some twins that have been born, that there's been a black twin and a white twin.
Yeah, but they're fraternal.
There were multiple fathers.
But each one has one father.
Correct.
So that would not be this case.
Okay.
Right? But it seems that Tosfos has at least considered the possibility that a person could have multiple fathers. And if you could have multiple fathers, why can't you have multiple mothers? So the question here is there a possibility that not only is the birth mother the mother, but so is the biological mother, and potentially both biological mothers in this case. Right? There is a logical possibility that a person in this case would have multiple mothers. Right? Right. Where do you go for yontif? That's what you're wondering. I know. I hear that.
Two sugars.
That's right. Children will never
this
get married.
This is the worst part.
That's right. That's right.
So biologically, that
I didn't think so.
Because what happens to the genetic material of each one of those?
Right. Logically, it's very hard to...
About the men?
Right. Correct. Correct. Right. I don't know if I care so much whether it can happen or not. The mere fact that Tosfos is willing to consider more than two parents is what I care about. So, we will now go through the modern-day writings on what people actually say on this case. The first one we have is Rav Usher Weiss. I don't know where this tshuva appears other than on his website.
This is 11, yeah?
And he gets this question, Vishal kvoda im trumas ha-mitochondria, that's that word in Hebrew, ha-yisha nachriya ma-din ha-yilod ha-im Yisrael o-goy, v'im basi im k'sher le-kahuna. What's this? All these questions. So he goes through it, and he has a very, very interesting approach. He has the approach, he follows the opinion of Paddy, where he says that, you know what? We follow the majority. And since the majority of the egg is the nuclear DNA, we therefore ignore the rest. So it takes, a look at the two paragraphs on the bottom. Ach, mikol makom nir benidon didan, kasher rubo ha'atzim shal chomer ha'Torah ashti, motzi begarin ha'beitzit shal em ha'yehudiya. The overwhelming majority of the relevant DNA is found in the nuclear DNA, which came from the Jewish mother, not from the mitochondrial donor. Rak ha'alfis mimenu, maybe a thousandth of it, motzi becher kalakuch min ha'Torah emes ha'nachriya, Vaday mistabe dazrina basa harova ikerva havlad Yisrael lechol dover im aviv kohen hu kach din havlad. So he follows this idea that you follow majority, and based on the majority rule, what matters is the nuclear DNA, and if the other stuff is from a non-Jewish woman, we don't care. Now, he says, the truth be told, if this practically happens, he would recommend as follows. Ach, the emes, truth be told, Iker Cheri Mima near Bainai borrow plush the you talking call me bechinas rochesh you are Adam Shteimos. First he says it's impossible to have two mothers. Okay, now everybody agrees with that. Shem Shisha Shiuroshne Avos. Just like you can't have two fathers. You can't just say they both are, it's one or the other. Therefore, near Pasha the Tzorich Lerech Acher Ha'ikrish Be'ekom Le'salim Min HaTafel Shebetfeilim. You got to start with what's important. However, he says what he would say to do practically. Al Pidati Hakavua De'Nias Geirish Eishra Hachmir B'Makom Ha'Efsha Ad Katzei Ha'Efsha. He said, therefore, he said, even though I don't think you need it, I would recommend that you do a conversion on this child just to be safe. However, let's say it's a girl that's born from that, and she grows up and she wants to marry a Kohen. Says you can ignore the fact that she converted, because really she didn't need it, and she can marry the Kohen.
Mm-hmm.
It's Luchumra. I'm doing it to be safe, but the truth of the matter is, when push comes to shove, I don't think I need it. What?
Suggesting to cover her in all directions, basically.
Right. So that is his opinion. This opinion of Rav Usher Weiss is not universally accepted, shall we say. The idea of following the row, following the majority, is very questionable. In general, let's say when it comes to a mixture of things, if it was, for example, if I have something that is non-kosher, that falls into 60 of kosher, if it's something that's very important, it's not batel, right? We can't ignore it. right? If it's a very intense flavor, for example. If it's something that is davar hamamid, it allows this to maintain its shape. It allows this to exist, etc. Right? If it's achaticha ruis kabed ba, if it's something that's very important, so therefore they say, even if you're going to follow the rules here, which we're not sure you should, mitochondrial DNA is pretty important. Yeah, it might be a small amount, but you can't get by without it. So therefore, to say to ignore it, that is hard to imagine. So in the Shut Binyan Av, Rav Bakshi Daron gets the same question, and he writes that overwhelmingly, he thinks you should not do this. That the amount of problems that they should not do a mitochondrial DNA replacement.
Just stay away from the thing.
Just stay away from the whole thing. What?
What does he care about?
Because, for example, there are all sorts, there are opinions out there that will say, well, for starters, let's say they're two Jewish women, right, etc. He has a long piece here, and again, if anyone's interested in reading it in English, Rabbi Bleich has a longer piece in English about it, where it talks about there are certain ways that you're supposed to make children and certain ways you're not supposed to make children. And there's supposed to be a normal family with one mother and one father. And this is a violation of that. Rabbi Bleich came out with an article entitled Mitochondrial DNA Replacement, How Many Mothers? Where he comes out very, very strongly against the entire procedure. That being said, though, he says you still have to answer the question if someone does it. In summation, it can be stated that apart from the serious concern presented by crossing the germline that may affect the very nature of future generations of human beings, the potential for harm to the prospective neonate as a result of the mitochondrial DNA replacement puts an assumption of risk to a potential human being that, even if not formally interdicted, is antithetical to moral principles announced by the sages of the Talmud. Moreover, formidable rabbinic opinion maintained that blurring of maternal identity and commingling of male sperm with genetic material of the wife of another man is prohibited by halacha. Post factum, whether the birth mother is to be recognized as the sole halachic mother or whether the child has multiple mothers remains a matter of significant dispute.
This is makar, that you can't have multiple mothers.
What?
This is makar that you can have.
Yep, Sukkim and Noach it's based on. You can read the article. Ayin Shem v'Daikhetiv. But that's the story. So again, this is something that has happened already many times, and we can count on it happening many more times. Whether it will become popular for infertility of women that have egg quality issues remains to be seen, but inevitably it will be used, I would think, to fix problems of mitochondrial DNA disease from being passed down. And at that point, someone's going to have to answer this question. And Rabbi Bleich is right. You can sit there and shri chai v'kayim, you shouldn't do this. But once it gets done, someone's going to have to figure out what to do with it.
Being done.